This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last week, Israel conducted a lopsided prisoner exchange with Hezbollah. The Lebanese political and military group celebrated the return of five men Israelis regard as terrorists and handed over coffins containing the remains of two Israeli soldiers. We'll have more on the specifics in just a few moments, but the swap raises questions about how democracies deal with terrorists, non-state actors, and with outright enemies. Like the United States and many other democracies, Israel insists it does not negotiate with hijackers and terrorists, but in reality, there are many circumstances where ransoms are paid and prisoners exchanged. Some of those deals are public, some not. The media and public opinion play parts that governments do not always find helpful, and each agreement establishes precedents and sets parameters for future deals. Absolute positions are easy to declare, but sometimes difficult to maintain. Think Ronald Reagan and the Arms for Hostages deal. If you've been a prisoner or a captive, what did you want your government to do? Can a state abandon its citizens and its soldiers in enemy hands? Tell us your story. 800-989-8255 is the phone number. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, the long history of American bank runs from the Panic of 1809 to IndyMac. But first, prisoner swaps. In a few minutes, we'll talk with Natan Sharansky, who was thrown into the gulag in the old Soviet Union and eventually exchanged for a spy. He's now a politician in Israel who opposes prisoner swaps. But we begin with Amos Harrell. He's defense correspondent for Haaretz, a daily newspaper in Israel, and joins us on the line from his home outside Tel Aviv. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Good afternoon.
And Israel has a repeated long history of being involved in one-sided prisoner exchanges, not just with states, but with non-state actors. Why do they do it?
I think it's first and foremost it has to do with Israeli mentality. It's a small country. We take things very emotionally. We look at our prisoners of war as almost personal friends, as almost heroes, people that should be returned back at any cost. And the last prisoner swap is quite a good example for that, because we knew, or at least we presumed, that we were going to get only soldiers' bodies back, but still we gave Hezbollah in Lebanon back five prisoners, one of them a man who was actually convicted of murdering two Israeli soldiers. And if you look at the history of prisoner swaps in the last 20 years, in many cases, Israel did give back hundreds of Palestinian and Lebanese prisoners, sometimes for one or two soldiers who were alive at the hands of the enemy.
So given the presumption that there were going to be coffins in exchange for these five Lebanese and also the remains of some Lebanese who died in Israeli hands, there was more involved than just that. But nevertheless, Israel had to know, the government had to know, that this would be a tremendous victory for Hezbollah, that this would be trumpeted as the final completion of their objectives of the war a couple of years ago.
True, but on the other hand, it's again, the symbolism works both ways, because Israel, Israel's Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert, has announced in the beginning of the war that he was in fact retaliating because of the abduction and that he wants those soldiers back. We needed a sort of a closure for this thing. 2 years, the anniversary was last week, 2 years since the war started. We all know by now that it was a failure. At least Israel itself considers it an Israeli failure. And he had to end the story. And, of course, it wasn't an established fact that they were both dead. Hezbollah, in a very cruel way, kept that a secret. It's true that Israeli intelligence has received information that it was presumed that both of them had died during the abduction, but Hezbollah actually refused to tell us until the last moment. If you looked at the pictures from the border crossing, you could see the Hezbollah top negotiator refusing to answer Lebanese journalist's question until the last minute, until the coffins were shown. So this was a personal tragedy for the two families, and I think Olmert felt obligated to end this and to bring those soldiers, even if they were bodies, to bring them back to be buried in Israel. And the price isn't enormous. We're talking of five people returned to Lebanon, one of them a terrorist, the other prisoners of war, Hezbollah fighters, it's not the same price we're discussing. As you know, we have an abducted soldier, Gilad Shalit, who remains in the hand of Hamas in Gaza for more than 2 years. There, he is alive, and therefore the price discussed is hundreds and maybe 1,000 Palestinian prisoners who will be released to get him back.
What was the role of public opinion and the media in this negotiation?
Both played a very big role. I think public opinion, except for maybe a small minority in the right-wing politicians and voters from right-wing parties, most Israelis supported the deal. They didn't go to it with open hearts without being too happy about it. But the feeling was that we needed closure, we needed the end of this tragedy, and we needed to know if these soldiers are alive or dead, and to bring them back to the families. The general opinion was that it wasn't too much of a high price. People, of course, regretted those pictures coming from Beirut of almost a national holiday celebrations and so on, and all this for a man who, 30 years ago, as I've said, murdered Israeli children.
And what is the political fallout a week later after everybody, of course, knows that the men were dead?
I don't think that it's so great. Olmert, of course, is facing other problems right now. He's facing six different investigations on corruption scandals. His government is hardly does hardly survive. It's believed here that there will be elections in about 6 months' time. I don't think the fallout is too great, but I do see an influence of this deal on the next one because of the fate of Shalit, and we know that he's alive, and we know that there's a very narrow window of opportunity. If we want to bring him back, this has to be done in the next few months. Otherwise, he might disappear somewhere in Gaza. I think we see more and more Israeli, both Israeli citizens and politicians, who say the price this time is too high. And unlike Hezbollah, the struggle with Hamas is on a daily basis. If we release those prisoners, some of them, the Hamas demands a release of murderers who were involved in enormous attacks of suicide bombings in the last few years. If we release those people to the West Bank, to the Gaza Strip, we might face them, we might see them sending new terrorists in a very short time.
And finally, as we said at the outset, Israel's stated policy is it does not negotiate with terrorists and or with hijackers. How does the reality of deals, not just this deal, but deals with, not only its neighboring states, but with other terrorist organizations in the past, with Ahmed Jibril including.
As you mentioned in your opening remarks, there's always a difference, a huge gap between the stated policy and what actually happens behind the scenes. Now, Israel wouldn't admit it publicly. I think if you want to rephrase the policy, I think the right thing to say is that if Israel has a chance of getting soldiers or kidnapped civilians back by force, it will use it, and it has done so in the past. If you just have to go back 30 years to that remarkable operation in Entebbe, in Uganda, where a plane full of Israeli citizens who were hijacked was released by force by sending Israeli commandos thousands of kilometers into Africa to release them. So if there is an operational opportunity, then Israel would decide on this. If, like the case of the two soldiers, you don't have enough information, you don't know where they're kept, you don't know even if they're alive or dead, then you do negotiate. Again, I think the Olmert's problem was that he was, unlike Sharon or Rabin, who were much more careful, our previous prime ministers, who were more experienced on such issues and more careful about the way they talked. Olmert talked, I'd say he was too arrogant, too full of himself when this thing started in the beginning of the war, saying no negotiations, bringing them back by force, when actually if he talked to the right people, he should have known that this was impossible.
Amos Harel, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Amos Harel, defense correspondent for Haaretz, a daily newspaper in Israel, with us on the line from his home outside Tel Aviv. And we turn now to someone with direct experience with prisoner exchanges, Natan Sharansky. He was released from the Soviet Gulag 2 decades ago. He's a former Israeli politician now and the author of a number of books. His latest, Defending Identity, Its Indispensable Role in the Protection of Democracy. Today he joins us from a studio in Jerusalem, in Israel. And Natan Sharansky, nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Good evening and good afternoon.
And do you have any mixed feelings at all when you watched that prisoner exchange last week?
Oh, yeah, I have very mixed feelings. You know, each such act has human and principle side. And human side, yes, as it was said already, we are a small family. Everybody feels the feeling of brothers. We have a lot of compassion to the families. We want our boys, or even dead bodies of our boys, we want them back. The principal side is, what about security of all our citizens? Is it becoming stronger or weaker? Security of them today and tomorrow. And each such deal creates precedent for the next one, where the price is becoming bigger and motivation for terrorists higher. And that's why, well, it's easy to speak when you are not in the government, you don't have to vote yourself. But with the previous deal, I was in the government and I voted against. And Prime Minister called me, Ariel Sharon called me and said before the vote, Natan, you were in prison. You have to understand why you have to vote for this, why you have to support me. I said, as the one who was in prison and who knows that it is very important that your country is fighting for you. But it's also, you also know that there is price which should not be paid. I personally refused to be released when I was asked to pay a price for which I believed was weakening our movement, when I had to sign a letter which I didn't want to sign, and I preferred to stay a few more years in prison, but not to give up on the interests of our struggle, on bigger concept of security for our struggle, for our movement, for our country. And the same is here. Yeah, I'm very torn apart. On one hand, I'm all with the families. On the other hand, I think that it is irresponsible to give such a high motivation to terrorists to continue with their acts.
Just to clarify, you were talking about your case. You were held in the Soviet Union. You were accused of espionage. In fact, you were a political prisoner, an activist for Soviet Jewry, and were eventually exchanged in a spy swap, which really you had no control over.
Well, that's something different. Look, I was, Americans were insisting for all these years that I'm not spy, and of course I wasn't. The Soviets were insisting that I'm a spy. And so when there was a swap between few spies from both sides, I was released half hour before this. There is no principal price which was paid by Russia or America for this. But when they were ready to release me for making some principal concessions for which all our movement will suffer, I refused and preferred to stay in prison. And I think Prime Minister has to decide that the interest security of all our citizens demands from him to take this difficult decision.
We have to go to a short break. Stay with us. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about prisoner exchanges and how democracies deal with terrorists and other enemies. If you've found yourself in this situation, you or a member of your family has been captured or kidnapped, what did you want your government to do? What, in fact, did they do? Give us a call. Tell us your story. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Can a state abandon its citizens and soldiers in enemy hands? Our guest is Natan Sharansky, a former Soviet dissident and political prisoner, now an activist in Israel. His latest book is called Defending Identity, Its Indispensable Role in Protecting Democracy. And Mr. Sharansky, if you would tell us just a little bit more about this most recent agreement, and again, the precedent which it sets. As we mentioned earlier, there's another Israeli soldier being held, this time in the Gaza Strip. Do you fear that the price will be even higher next time and the time after that?
It's always when we are making this type of concessions to terrorists, the price next time is higher. The previous exchange, which was 3 years ago, when for the first time we agreed in exchange for the three coffins, three bodies, dead bodies of our soldiers, and one drug dealer to release hundreds of terrorists, when Ariel Sharon was asking me to support this deal, and I refused, I wrote then that next time we will be releasing terrorists only for the dead bodies. Because now they got the principle that the price, the value of human life, and the value even of human emotions, of solidarity with the families, is so high and so deep in our society, and correctly so, that we will be ready to pay the highest price, and terrorists will use it, and next time the price will be higher. And here comes the deal where no alive citizens of our country are released. There are only two bodies and five terrorists. Now, when we really want our soldier who was captured, who was on mission of the State of Israel, who was captured, of course we have to do everything to release him. The price now became much higher, and our enemies are talking about hundreds of thousands of terrorists. And the only way to stop it is to make the terrorists feel that the price which they are paying for making such acts of terror is almost unbearable for them. Just before there was mentioned Entebbe, I have to tell you that Entebbe, the release of Israeli hostages thousands of miles from Israel by Israeli army, happened just before I went to prison. And 9 years that I was in prison, it was the image of Entebbe, of the country which will make everything to release you, which was supporting me. Each time when in Siberia, I heard the airplane, the engine of some Soviet airplane, of course, I inevitably thought about the airplanes sent by Israel to release hostages. That's what gives the hope. And if we are paying higher and higher and higher price to terrorists, it only decreases our hopes.
Let's get a caller in on the conversation. A number again, 800-989-8255. And Michael is calling us. Michael is calling us from Saudi Arabia.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I'm a Swiss citizen, and I was thrown in jail for a couple of weeks in Saudi for being accused of taking photos. I'm a photographer, and they accused me of taking photos around a restricted area. It was an unmarked restricted area, and I was thrown in jail for about 2 weeks, and the Swiss did almost nothing to get me out. The only reason I got out is because just before they took my cell phone away from me, I messaged a friend of mine, and he made a few phone calls, and they managed to get me out. I was told that the Swiss called the Ministry of Interior, but they did nothing after that. They were told that they didn't know where I was, and then they just did nothing, and I would probably still have been in there for a couple more weeks after that if the people I knew didn't actually make effort to find me.
This seems, I guess, more of a diplomatic situation. Were you ever formally charged?
No, I was thrown in jail. There was no papers ever. I signed at the end. Yes, they released me, and I signed a document saying I will not do this again, et cetera, et cetera. But there was no actual being arrested for this because I was for a period of 3 or 4 days. No one told me what the actual reasoning was.
Mm-hmm.
I surmised it because I can understand Arabic very badly, but I surmised it from what they were saying to each other. And
I have to ask you, Michael, you went through this experience and you're calling us now from Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, it's a funny country. It's interesting and it's got its moments. I'm leaving very soon, though. So,
Michael, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Thanks you very much.
If I can comment on it, that Israel, wherever the citizen of Israel is in trouble, Israel, on all the levels, is mobilized immediately. And that's really the greatness, the good side of our country, and the fact that we are so concerned about his or her life. The problem is that the government has to think not only about the life of this specific person, but also how we are fighting with terrorists in order to protect the lives of all our citizens. And also, Michael signed the paper that he will not do it again, and it wasn't really principal case because he didn't know himself what he
had done in the first place. Yes.
Well, I refused to sign the paper that I will not do it again because it was a very principal case and the struggle of hundreds of thousands of Soviet Jews depended on it.
Let's see if we can get Thais on the line. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. She's calling us from Portland, Oregon.
Yes, you did.
Go ahead, please.
Hi, everyone. First of all, I was just telling the person that my mom was a hostage at Nordost about 5 years ago. And the Chechen terrorists were holding them down. And the only thing they were asking for, they didn't ask for money or to let anybody out as soon as I remember. They just wanted the troops out of Chechnya at that time.
Which would have been a very important concession.
Excuse me?
Which would have been a major concession by the Russian government.
Yes.
And what happened? What did you want the Russian government to do?
Well, she said that they were actually treating them very... humane as much as they can, and the only thing they wanted was the end of the war. So I think it's somewhat similar with the Israel, and I completely agree with his comment that he made before that, you know, if you pay them once, they're going to just keep on doing it and doing it. So unless you can resolve the problem somehow,
but
you know, in another way.
You must have known while your mom was being held hostage that this was a price the Russian government would not pay.
Yeah, I did. And I was very worried. And my friends were telling me that, you know, the odds of survival are very, very slim, if none. And, you know, I'm very grateful that the siege happened because I think, you know, without it, nothing would have been resolved anyway. A lot more people would have died. So.
Well, did your mom make it out okay?
Yes, she did.
Well, congratulations for that. Appreciate it. And Natan Sharansky, that raises another point. It's not just the exchange of men. There was that celebration in Beirut. This provides Hezbollah, which hardly needs it, but even more political legitimacy. And in the past, Israel has made swaps with people like Ahmed Jibril, and that gives him legitimacy, too. Political status is part of these agreements.
No doubt. First of all, it reminds to everybody how different are these two societies. We celebrate life, they celebrate death, and they say it proudly. For them, this awful terrorist is big national hero. But this formula, we celebrate life and they celebrate death, what seems for us is a big power of our society. In their eyes, is big strength of their society. That's exactly what I'm writing about in the book Defending Identity, that they believe that they are ready to die for something, and they think that we are not ready to die for anything, that they can blackmail us with the life of one of our citizens and to get everything. And that's something very dangerous, and that's why our strong will has to strengthen our democracy and freedom. And that's why we have our leaders, our prime minister, our government, when they're making these decisions, they have to understand that with this goes very principal thing of giving more legitimacy and more motivation to terrorists.
Let's get Leonard on the line. Leonard with us from Parma in Ohio.
Hi, Neil. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you.
That's good. I appreciate you taking my call. I'm a former Marine, U.S. Marine, and I volunteered to serve my country, and I knew the risks of going to war. I was prepared to, if ever being caught and becoming a prisoner of war, I was prepared for that. I don't believe that any government should bargain away, especially when you have somebody like this guy that was just, I don't remember his name, that was just turned back to Lebanon.
Guntar.
He was a criminal. He killed people. How can you turn? I feel very sorry for the people, the parents, the loved ones of the dead Israeli soldiers. I do feel very sorry for them. But if you go deep into religion, I mean, it's not the body that goes to heaven; it's the soul.
Yeah.
So wherever these dead soldiers are, their soul is in heaven. And now you have convicted terrorists back out there, and they're going to go and they're going to ply their trade again.
Leonard, you say that. As a Marine, I presume you were also ready to risk your life to bring back the bodies of dead Marines on the battlefield.
Yes, I was. I was. I was prepared to do that. If it wasn't possible, then it wasn't possible. But that was the Marine Corps credo. We do not leave behind our dead. Yes.
And how are the situations different? Should the government leave behind its dead?
You're putting a larger population at risk when you take a man that is a convicted killer, a terrorist. I mean, he's not just a killer. A terrorist is worse than just a killer. He's going to go back out there, and he's going to gather up more to follow him, and he's going to be more of a danger to your society. That would be the difference.
Leonard, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And Natan Sharansky, I presume you would have very little argument with that.
Well, I have very little argument. I only want to mention that big number of Israeli reserve officers and soldiers wrote a letter, and they asked not to negotiate with any terrorist or other part about releasing their bodies if, God forbid, they will be killed. Not to release any of the terrorists in exchange for their bodies.
Natan Sharansky, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate
it.
Thank you. Natan Sharansky, a former Israeli politician, the author of a number of books, his most recent, Defending Identity, Its Indispensable Role in Protecting Democracy. And he joined us today from a studio in Jerusalem, in Israel. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. As a rule, the United States does not engage in prisoner exchanges, but that was not the case during the Civil War, when the North and South ironed out an informal agreement on prisoner swaps. How many Confederate officers equaled a Union private? Jeffrey Wirt is here to tell us. He's an historian and author specializing in the American Civil War, and he joined us today from a studio at member station WPSU in University Park in Pennsylvania. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Good afternoon.
And what was the exchange program that was set up between the Union and the Confederacy?
Well, it began slowly. The key thing initially was that President Abraham Lincoln refused any kind of an arrangement with the Confederate government that might recognize the Confederacy as a legitimate government. So nothing occurred early. And then after the first Battle of Bull Run, which was a Union defeat in July of 1861, the Quartermaster General of the Army, Montgomery Meigs, made a suggestion or indicated to the the federal government that maybe they want to consider prisoner exchange because hundreds of Union soldiers had been captured. But nothing really occurred then for another year. And it wasn't until really in July of 1862, after Union successes that winter and then in the West particularly, but then the Confederacy had successes around Richmond at the end of June 62 that both governments agreed to, and it was specifically as far as Lincoln was concerned, that there would be no formal recognition in any way of the Confederacy. So they set up this cartel or prisoner exchange program that would run for a year or more, and then it would be delayed. But
was a military agreement, not a political agreement.
Exactly. It was a military agreement because Lincoln did not want to have, as I said, anything that could be construed as a formal recognition of the Confederacy.
And there was a strange formula that developed. If you had a major general in prison on your side, you could exchange him for a number of other people. Lives were worked out in proportion.
Yes, they were. If you were a general, and of course that was the highest rank, just general, and none were captured. But if a general was captured, he was worth 46 privates. If a major general was captured, he was worth 40, brigadier general 20, and then it went down, colonel, went down finally to a sergeant or a corporal, an NCO, who was worth 2 privates. And this is the arrangement they made, yes.
Sergeants would be outraged. Eventually, this program collapsed. How come?
Collapsed for a number of reasons. But the critical reason occurred after the Emancipation Proclamation, in which Lincoln signed on January 1st, 1863, which, with the proclamation, allowed the North to recruit and enlist African-Americans. I imagine many listeners are familiar with the famous 54th Massachusetts.
And the film Glory, yes.
And the film Glory. But in fact, most of the African-Americans would serve in what are called United States Colored Troops units. And altogether, somewhere like 180,000 African-Americans served in the Union Army. Well, of course, the Confederacy was outraged by this. And the Congress passed a law, Confederate Congress, that and all the colored troops units, as they were called, were officered by white men. And so Confederate Congress made these officers, if captured, be treated as criminals, and that they refused to exchange black soldiers that were captured. They simply wouldn't do this. So the Lincoln government, in turn, could not accept this or tolerate this. And so the prisoners' exchanges started to slow down. They'd always been an uneven thing. They were plagued by paperwork, which is not surprising, and things like that. And so finally then, though, in the spring of 1864, when Ulysses S. Grant was made general-in-chief of all the Union forces, Grant was adverse to this. and he finally refused, or he stopped the prisoner exchange program, arguing that for every Confederate prisoner exchanged, they will be returned to the ranks and they will fight against the, you know, the Union forces
and
again.
And if it was a battle of attrition, these exchanges would favor the South.
Absolutely. And Grant knew that they had a much larger manpower population
in the North,
in which to, yeah. Yes, and so he could draw from that where the Confederacy was limited.
Jeffrey Wirt, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there.
Okay.
Jeffrey Wirt, an historian and author specializing in the American Civil War, Cavalryman of the Lost Cause is his upcoming book. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Stay with us. Americans share one cultural touchstone on the subject of bank panics.
Don't look now, but there's something funny going on over there at the bank, George. I've never really seen one, but that's got all the earmarks of being a run.
That run on the Bailey Building and Loan happened in the movies. It's a Wonderful Life, of course, and George Bailey, played by Jimmy Stewart, calmed his depositors of Bedford Falls.
You're thinking of this place all wrong, as if I had the money back in a safe. The money's not here. Well, your money's in Joe's house, that's right next to yours, and in the Kennedy house, and Mrs. Maitland's house, and 100 others. You're lending them the money to build, and then they're going to pay it back to you as best they can. Now, what are you going to do, foreclose on them?
Fast forward, and earlier this month, California-based IndyMac became the largest bank to fail in two decades after a run depleted its deposits. The bank had lost more than $700 million in the final two quarters of last year. As rumors became reality, panicked, angry, and worried customers formed long lines around IndyMac banks to withdraw their funds. And George Bailey's honeymoon fund was not available this time around. In Sunday's Los Angeles Times, historian Jane Kamensky wrote an op-ed called Boom and Bust, It's the American Way, where she describes the cycles of absolute trust in banks and occasional moments of total panic. If you've ever been in a bank run on either side of the teller's window, what was it like? Tell us your story. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Jane Kamensky is chair of the history department at Brandeis University, author of The Exchange Artist, A Tale of High-Flying Speculation and America's First Banking Collapse. She joins us from member station WBUR in Boston, Massachusetts. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
And you open your op-ed with a phone call from your mother-in-law.
My mother-in-law really is a little old lady from Pasadena, and she called my husband earlier this month to ask whether she should pull some money out of IndyMac. And he explained that the FDIC was behind the bank, but that a bank that big would probably not fail. Everything should stay calm. And, of course, he, like many other IndyMac customers, found that their confidence was misplaced earlier last week when the bank was taken over by the FDIC and the runs kept happening.
The FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and if you've got $100,000 or less in your bank account, you're covered.
And if you have more than $100,000 in your bank account, you're not in as good shape. In this case, the FDIC, through the new IndyMac Federal, will pay out a guaranteed 50% of the money over $100,000, the rest to be negotiated with the eventual liquidation of the assets of the bank. But it's going to take a while, and there will have to be some luck involved for people to get more than that out.
And even those who are totally covered, it was not like they could, use their debit card anymore.
No, and I think that's the disturbing characteristic of a bank run for depositors is we all buy the fiction that, as George Bailey said in It's a Wonderful Life, the money's right there back in the safe, that the debit cards we hold are in the old days, the promissory notes that said they were convertible for hard currency could be redeemed in an instant, and the money was sitting there waiting for us. Of course, a bank can't operate that way if it doesn't loan out some of what it takes in deposit. It can't make the money to pay its investors a return. So in a way, banking is always a species of theater that makes us believe that what's going on behind the curtain is solid and transparent, but that requires a degree of controlled risk-taking. Sometimes that risk-taking gets out of control.
We're talking with historian Jane Kamensky. If you'd like to join the conversation on bank runs, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Marie is on the line. Marie with us from Denver, Colorado.
Hi.
Hi there.
Actually, I don't know how many people remember the 1982 collapse of Penn Square Bank in Oklahoma City, but my parents and I all had our accounts there. and woke up one morning to hear that it was being taken over by the FDIC, and we all went down to get our money and stood in line for 2 or 3 days.
For 2 or 3 days?
Yeah.
And did you get it out, Maria?
I did. We did, because we had it broken up in separate accounts, less than $100,000. But what was so funny, I mean, it was kind of, it was a weird atmosphere because people were worried, of course, but at the same time, there were other banks out there passing out cards and passing out water and, you know, hi, get your money, bring it to us. We'll protect you. So, I mean, you know, it got funny after a while. But, yes, because the bank had been taken over by the FDIC, it did take quite a while to get everybody's accounts out.
Maria, I'm glad you and your parents managed to survive. Of course, 26 years later, it might not have been so funny then.
But a couple things about Maria's experience that are somewhat typical is the idea that you wake up in the morning and it's gone. So that confidence isn't something that you realize you're placing. And when it evaporates, it's gone in an instant. It reminds me of that old Gary Larson cartoon where the cows look up and say, oh, dear, this is grass. We've been eating grass. So it's gone in an instant. There's a collective response that if it leaks from bank to bank can become not just a bank run but a panic. And then Maria opened her comment by saying, I don't know if you remember, and most of us won't, because a process of forgetting takes over almost immediately. Banks have failed at least every generation for 200 years. Hundreds of banks, over 700 banks, failed in the S&L crisis between 1986 and 1991. And yet it is shocking to us to see this central casting bank run played out on the television, the front pages of the newspaper around the world. Our confidence recovers. We place it merrily again. And then, like Claude Rains in Casablanca, we're shocked to find ourselves back in that same long line.
Marie, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it.
Sure.
And you mentioned the psychology. For a long time, banks, the architecture of banks was, well, derived from the castle. These were protected things. You had to cross a moat, practically, to get into the bank.
Oh, something to the castle and something to the chapel as well, I think, to sort of sanctify and ennoble the process of giving and taking credit, which, you know, into the early modern period had been something that stockjobbers did in alleys and not at all considered a dignified process. The book I wrote about the first American banking process, The Exchange Artist, details the creation of the Detroit Bank in the early part of the 1800s. And with no real assets to put in the bank, the Boston founders of this bank dragged over land for over 1,000 miles, iron-barred doors, elaborate Windsor-style chairs and furnishings. The thing looked like a bank, and that was very important to the theater of banking. If you look, even today, if you visit the Treasury Department in Washington, D.C., they can show you the cash room that was there while our currency was redeemable for gold. And there's enough marble in that castle, in that cash room to cover the Vatican. There wasn't enough gold in the bank, gold in the back, to pay everybody who came in and asked to redeem their bills. But when you came in, you thought that you were in a sanctified space. And that was important to making banking a legitimate activity, to domesticating risk, to making risk part of a bureaucracy, something that was modulated and plausible on a day-to-day basis.
Let's get Daniel on the line. Daniel's calling us from Boston, Massachusetts.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Good. So, you know, I actually had a similar situation. I was 10, living overseas in Central America in the Canal Zone, when the only bank in town, the only American bank in town, failed. I remember being a kid and thinking, you know, not really understanding this at all. But I also wonder, you know, whether or not we've got ourselves into this problem even more so. The fact that, and I remember my parents, after this experience, taking money out for the week, having cash on hand, and whether in this world of ATM withdrawals and debit transactions, we sort of are primed for our own emergency.
What do you think, Jane?
Well, I think that the good old days when we were thrifty and sensible are greatly exaggerated. I think in most respects we're in a lot better shape in our financial culture than we were in the pre-FDIC regime before 1933 or before the Federal Reserve System and its modern incarnation was set up. I guess, Daniel, as individuals, I can see that we're in perhaps less tangible communication with our money on a day-to-day basis.
Our mattresses are thinner, yes.
Our mattresses are thinner, and the plastic-holding parts of our wallets may be thicker. But anybody who doubts that a regulatory regime can work, or anybody who thinks that a free market system unchecked can take care of our financial sector should look at the early 19th century compared to the post-Great Depression 20th.
My parents were actually raised in the Depression. I think that changed their attitude, and this experience, you know, sort of harkened back to that for them. You know, that first of all, money wasn't available. You know, the fact that they couldn't have that was their own was, I think, a great, made a change in their own financial planning.
And certainly there have been parts of the early decade or the early years of this current century that have felt like the bubble of the 1920s as well.
Yeah, yeah. Daniel, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking about bank runs with historian Jane Kamensky. She's with us from our member station WBUR in Boston. Her book is called The Exchange Artist, A Tale of High-Flying Speculation and America's First Banking Collapse. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Jane, you talked about the theater of banking. You write about Andrew Dexter Jr. in this first collapse, but he and people like Charles Ponzi, the difference between theater and con game is very subtle.
Yeah, I think in general the difference between the kind of noble speculation that built the country and the ignoble speculations that bilk the country can be subtle. I guess I'd fight for the difference between Dexter and Ponzi, though. I think Dexter, like a lot of early speculators, was fundamentally a pretty public-spirited individual. I write in my book, and I wrote in that op-ed about the object of his paper pyramid, which was to build a tall building in Boston that would be an ennobling public space for commerce. It didn't have his name on it. It wasn't Dexter Tower. It wasn't a mansion in the Caribbean. I think he really wanted to do well by doing good, as the old Tom Lehrer song said. Ponzi was a criminal. Ponzi came to the United States famously with a couple of dollars in his pocket, came through Boston, went to Montreal, where he got involved in some sort of small-time hustling, including check forgery. So he had served time in Canada before he came back to Boston and started his big paper pyramid scheme. And unlike Dexter, Ponzi's had nothing at the base of it. It was just a pure bilk and run scheme that didn't wind up with him running fast enough or far enough.
Yeah, but he built quite a big pyramid before it all fell down.
Yeah, and he built it fast, and I think that's that dynamic of confidence coalescing and then coming apart very quickly. It's a very, very fickle substance. In the 19th century, they talked about the easy consoling train of thought that took you from a piece of paper with funny drawings on it to the imagination that there was gold or something else of real value at the end of it. And I guess, you know, in our day, as Daniel was suggesting earlier, that train's gotten even longer, you know, from pixels to plastic to paper to the idea that there's value somewhere.
Now let's get Jessica on the line. Jessica with us from Salt Lake City in Utah.
Yes. I have most of my money in credit unions. And do credit unions run the same as banks? Or can there be a run on a credit union like a bank? Or how does that work?
If a credit union is FDIC insured, it has the same protection as any bank. There can be a run on anything. The collapse of Bear Stearns in March of this year, though Bear is not in any classical sense a deposit-holding bank.
Investment bank, yeah.
An investment bank, but with no individuals who would be able to run on it, was a run. A run simply means that people want their money out at once. The run on IndyMac last week, where we saw the lines snaking around the branches. In fact, that wasn't what broke them. That was a sort of ex post facto phenomenon. The real run was mostly online and over the phone as people pulled their money out. So you can run on anything that's holding capital.
So, Jessica, you should check to make sure that your credit union is protected by the FDIC.
I will.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Can I ask another question?
Sure.
Are credit unions safer in that they're more the people's money more rather than investors like in a bank?
You know, I think for the most part, banks are safe. The $100,000 per deposit limit that the FDIC set is, for most of us, an extremely generous limit. And what the FDIC has created in 1933 after the failure of more than 4,000 banks in the first month of that year alone. And between about 1935, when the FDIC regime starts working, and the mid-1970s, it creates a stable banking system. There are no major failures. It helps with other arms of the government work us through the S&L crisis. People shouldn't panic. We're all better off, even in situations where a bank is unstable, we're all better off taking a pause. So, Jessica, I don't know the circumstances of your particular savings and loan, but in general, banks are safe, and when they overextend themselves, we now have public mechanisms that help them correct themselves.
Thanks, Jessica. Okay,
thank you.
Bye-bye. And nevertheless, your book reminds us the cycles may be less violent than they used to be, but nevertheless, banks sometimes fail.
Indeed. Banks often fail. Between 1865 and the beginning of the bubble in 1921, there is no year that a bank doesn't fail. Across the population, those failures are better and better contained than they used to be, which is not to say that there haven't been and won't continue to be a lot of very painful individual stories as people work their way through the losses of current weeks and years.
Jane Kamensky, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Neil.
Jane Kamensky, chair of the History Department at Brandeis, author of The Exchange Artist, A Tale of High-Flying Speculation and America's First Banking Collapse. She joined us today from member station WBUR in Boston. Tomorrow, Ken Rudin joins us, the political junkie at the Newseum. You join us, too. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.